For your information, just thought I'd mention it. The next one of these will be on the answer to Job, and that's January 19th. And the following one will be on February 16th. And I originally said it was going to be on psychology of the transference and auroric insurgents. I think that's biting off too much. I think I'm just going to limit it to psychology of the transference. God willing, heat cooperating. Administrators becoming human. We will meet at the Methodist Medical Building, but we'll stay tuned on that one.
And then 9 to 3 or 9:30.
Yeah, 9:30 to what we say? 9:30 to 3:30. Yeah. Give it. It will start at 9:30. We'll end when we end. Both times. Yeah. The January 19th and February 16th.
Okay.
Did you get the dates? Well, let's go back to the line of inquiry we're dealing with. Two fish, then you look to another tradition where the Redeemer is said to be dual, and which will, the duality which will be united at the end of time to kind of back up his idea that it's not crazy to look at the duality in the Christ portrayal, duality in the fish, as being something that's at least in potential, aiming toward reconciliation, toward union. And then he looks at the symbolism of the fish, on the one hand being concupiscentia, and on the other hand being an image of Christ, that is of purity, just the opposite. And then he looks at the idea that the fish is eaten in Christianity as the essentially what's happening in the Mass, to suggest that the eating of the fish is going to be an image that's going to return when we're dealing with synthesis. That will be an image of synthesis, eating of the fish, but not just the good fish, but the fish as good and bad. Well, that's just, he's building an argument here. He's going to go to one more image to really substantiate this, and I think it'll be more clear if we look at that one. And that's paragraph 178. I'm just going to take out two sentences from that paragraph. go to the bottom of page 115. Go up 1, 2, 3, 4 lines. According to the Syrian apocalypse of Baruch, Leviathan shall rise from the sea with the advent of the Messiah. Now, Leviathan, here's a picture of Leviathan from Blake. Leviathan appears a couple of places in the Bible. One of the places that Jung makes a book of it is in the book of Job. And Leviathan is a sea fish, sea monster fish, and Behemoth is the land monster. So Leviathan as the fish, in the negative version, is going to come up out of the water at the advent of the Messiah, which is, in other traditions, the healing of the Messiah. He's working symbolically how these images overlap. And then, to really make his point, go over to 116. So one, two, three, four, five lines up. According to the Apocalypse of Baruch, Behemoth as well as Leviathan is a Eucharistic food.
Is a Eucharistic what?
Food. So now these two, this text, the Apocalypse of Baruch, is Jewish apocalyptic and apocryphal literature. But in that version, in that account, the fish returns, and it's a negative fish. It's the fish that represents everything that you're not supposed to be. That becomes the host. And that's what he's been driving at all along. The image of synthesis is when that negative fish, the fish of concupiscencia, becomes a meal that is sacred. Or in our language, when dealing with that second fish becomes the vehicle for ascertaining the spirit. That, in a nutshell, is the point of this book.
Bless you.
So that the problem that the Christian eon has given us is to confront the material excess that we've inherited from the last 1,000 years of history and to find the spirit embedded in it.
We have a tendency to lock it up, though, imprison it, you know, literally, figuratively, both, you know, the dark side.
Well, the dangers are that the dark side is disregarded as dark, and the spirit is approached separate from matter. Separate from the matter. When I mean matter, I mean desire, I mean bodily processes, lust, greed, anything that moves your life or is part of your life in the material sphere.
So what you want is the spirit with matter?
Spirit within the matter.
You see, that's the central prayer of Buddhism. Om Mani Padme Hum means finding the jewel of illumination within the lotus of the world.
Mm-hmm. That's it. We're going to go a step further. Let me just anticipate it. Remember, for Jung, the spirit is a independent, inherited, I don't even know what word to use, drive is not quite right, dynamism, propensity, it's built into human nature. And that's what we're trying to find in our analytic journey. Where is your inner guidance? It's another way of saying, where's your spirit? What's your spirit doing? Jung feels that we do have in us the knowledge of where our life can go, evolve, how we best can move forward to a complete life.
Is it synonymous with soul?
I think it's a little different. He doesn't give me a completely satisfying definition of soul. What I would call soul is the conscious feminine. That may be just using one word for another word. I think the best word, best way to describe soul, whatever Motown has, that's soul. It's I think it's closer. It's a kind of capacity for relationship.
Soul?
Yeah. It's a kind of capacity. It's a capacity for relationship. I'm kind of paraphrasing Jung a little bit. But soul I take as the ability to connect, the warmth of connecting, the joy that comes to you when you do connect. Where spirit is more a knowledge of where to go, what choices to make, what path to choose, what attitudes to begin to embody, what attitudes to let go. It's really inner advice. But Jung's, presupposition is that advice really does know where you're going. As you probably heard me say, Jung's an essentialist. He thinks you're born who you are, and that there is a way to live your life to make that potential you real. And that is what the spirit does. Spirit is the advice giver, the knowledge base, so to speak, that leads you or can lead you forward. It's not ego. It's an inner knowing that we see, of course, in dreams. And
so what you're saying is the spirit is what we're looking for, the soul is how we do it.
That's not a bad way to put it. Yeah. I think soul and receptivity are awfully close. And certainly they have to work together. But I think of spirit more as knowledge. The knowledge of what profession to take, what friends to have, what creative work to do, what next step to take.
If that's absent in a person, does that mean that they were born without it, or that they're maybe a destructive home environment from very
early? What's absent?
Pardon?
If what is absent?
The spirit.
I don't think it's ever absent.
But it's just like buried somewhere.
It's buried. Either too stubborn, or too prideful, too hateful, too self-hateful to listen to it.
Could you also say, though, that they're too entrapped by how spirit was defined by institutions?
Yes, I think you could.
I think that's what religion tries to do. It tries to manage that knowledge
and
the consequences on it.
Yeah.
So if you move towards in this direction and make these choices, here's what will happen.
Right.
And what now is happening is we're trying to fix. It's now being owned by the individual.
Right.
Or those of us.
Right. Yeah. That's just where I was going to go. Thank you. As far as Jung's concerned, Christianity as a spiritual phenomenon is valid up to about the year 1000. That Christianity really did articulate where society needed to go. But because of its separation from matter, it got squashed in the flip over to the material second half. So we've lost spirit. And now we've got to get it back. And I think in that sense, the astrological analogy is helpful. We really are at a crucial period in history, psychologically speaking. We can recover this spirit. But the place where we will recover it is not in the elevations anymore, but in the depths. It will come to us through matter. So I'm just again saying what I said, but from a slightly different perspective. Spirit is trying to press its way back in, free from its being monopolized by the church, and rebelling from its repression in the secular world. It says it's Christian, but it's not. It says it's spiritual, but it's not. We really do have a chance to connect with a if you were religious, you would say a divine level of intelligence. If you're not religious, and Jung tries to stay away from religious language, a non-ego guiding factor. But you got to get it by eating that second fish. So, pathology, psychological pathology, physical disease, you know, what's called narcissism today in many camps, the greed and disregard that is characterizes so much of our time, that's the second fish. And as far as Jung's concerned, in order to get the spirit, we've got to face that in ourselves and let it begin to transform itself so that we can hear the spirit at the heart of it.
Gary?
Yeah.
Because what you're talking about is to be able to attend to the spirit, you have to stop and listen. And it's like in the first 1,000 years, people listened by going to the church. It's kind of like
right.
The church was the one who was listening and then transferred it. But at the point where that had to be converted back into the person, so that each individual person was listening on their own.
Yeah.
The church tried to hold on to it.
Right.
And you know, if that had been transferred into the person at the time that we got material, you would have had inner guidance in the face of the material success, but we didn't.
Right.
The church kept the guidance, and then people stopped listening. To
right.
So all they did is they jumped into material success.
Exactly.
Now we're saying, okay, now we're rich, but we've got to start listening inside.
Mm-hmm. Yep. That's it. Well, and it's what we listen to.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, I think some of you have heard this, I'm not sure everyone has, but it's the clearest example I've had, and I brought along a dream of a guy to show you. So if you heard it, bear with me. If everybody's heard it, stop me. But the guy who was addicted to child porn, has everyone heard that?
No.
I was working with a fellow who was addicted to child porn, and he was a preacher. And as I knew his family, and I really had no worries that he was harming his own kids. He was an ethical guy, and the key here is ethical. But he was upset because he had to look at child porn, and he was in a small town where when he'd go to the porn shop, somebody could drive by and see his car. It was dangerous. Rather than say that is wrong, I just said, well, if you're going to do it, you might as well enjoy it. Well, that freaked him out right there. And I never said anything to him for about a year. We worked on some other issues. And one day I said to him, you know, sometime when you feel like looking at those magazines, why don't you just not do it and see what else you feel like doing? So he's willing to try that. And he lived with that for about 6 months. And he came back and he said, you know, I feel like playing war with toy soldiers. So I said, go out and buy a sandbox and start buying toy soldiers. And he did. He built a sandbox. He started not only buying toys, he started making them. He bought a little smelting setup, made toy soldiers, went bananas, recreating Civil War battles. And as he bring pictures of Civil War battles with his little toy soldiers, and he would read about battles, and he'd read about war, you know, Civil War battles, World War I battles, World War II battles, and he got obsessed with this stuff. And he did that for about a year, and then I said to him one day, well, sometime when you're doing that, don't do it, and just see if you can encapsulate for me what it is that's so exciting about doing that. So he did, and came back, and this was a very slow process, another 6 months or so. He said, well, you know what it is? What really interests me is history. So he started reading history. That toy soldier stuff was put aside. He started reading history. And about another 6 months, he said, you know, I've been reading about the foundation of Indiana, and I'm going to put together a museum exhibition on the founding of Indiana. And as a preacher in this small town, he had access to all the little old ladies' attics. He went around and collected hundreds of pictures of the founding of Indiana, put them together, made a huge, bought poster, you know, what do you call those, like easel things, you know, corkboard easel things, but made a huge exhibit of the founding of Indiana, got state funding, got it accepted in several museum shows, and his perversion was gone. See, at the heart of that perversion was a cultural interest, which if one could accept that and let it live with a responsible dialogue, the thing evolved into a cultural product. That's an example of eating the second fish. And the guidance then would be, the guy really did have an interest in history and became somewhat of an authority on that early phase of the founding of Indiana, to where his work was accepted and respected by historians and museum exhibitions. So the guidance is there, but it comes in these awful states. I think another key place that it shows up is in disease, physical disease. If you know how to work with it, sometimes at the heart of that disease is this guidance through life. I think that is the deeper therapeutic importance of this book, Ion. And it's why Jung tried to understand history, tried to understand where there's been excesses, tried to understand, okay, now what's that mean for us now? And his therapeutic approach was designed to help people work in this way. Not to moralize it, not to judge it, to see in the pathology, to see in the wrong thing, which we dismiss, thanks to DSM-4, as bad, to see in the wrong thing the way towards health, so that the negative is really the first emergence of a guidance that we have to learn to extract. Of course, now where Jung is going to go with this is alchemy. Alchemy is the specific set of symbols that Jung worked with, and that's where the book will go with in a moment, in looking at the alchemical understanding of the fish and what you do about it. Questions? Okay, so far? Mm-hmm. You're not being quiet because you don't understand.
Just very one quick comment. It seems to me that at this stage of history, in your time, you have to have the capacity to hold an incredible tension.
Yeah.
Because as I'm hearing about child pornography, of course, I go right to my own children and what if they did it. And so you can go that whole route. And so somehow you have to be able right now to hold two things that, I mean, two sides of you have to be able to really hold these tensions.
This only works for ethical people. That's true. And you see, that's the value of the first phase of history, that it really was about the attempt to generate an ethical ego. If you're dealing with a sociopath or character disorder of significant magnitude, they just go act on the thing. And we have to be able to, those who are doing this work, ascertain, can that individual confront the thing and not act it out? And if they can, and they can hold the tension between the desire and the responsibility, then the transformation can take place.
But that's why I asked about whether or not somebody has the spirit. I mean, is a character disordered or sociopathic person, are they without it, or is it just so badly damaged that it's not resuscitated?
I think it's there. It's just, it hits, when it comes up, it hits an irresponsible ego. And they can't, they're unable to stand the tension of the second fish's desire and not act it.
Is that a way of saying the ego container has to be strong enough?
Ego container has to be strong enough, definitely, yeah. Now with that guy that I mentioned, he drove considerable distance to see me, and he had, I think, 3 kids, all toddlers. And he brought his family because, you know, it was pretty much a shot a day to come see me. And his wife and his kids would come in and use my bathroom and get a glass of water. So I could observe him as a dad and he was a decent man. He just had this kooky spot.
Ego and the ethics one and the same thing? In other words, if the ego is sufficiently strong, that's where ethics resides.
Yes.
And if there isn't ethics there, that means that the ego is, it's kind of like in, I can't remember what that one was, the therapy that they talk about, the parent-child and the adult ego state and how the energy can shift back and forth. If your ego cannot be the strong enough to keep from being invaded, then there isn't any ethics.
Yes, I agree.
And that's what our culture is. I think that's what's happened to our culture. Our cultural ego, like you said, with the God image.
I don't know about that.
Well, you said, okay.
Well, the problem is, always is that, how can I put it? That state of excess, is it because the person has no ego and they're just bums? Or is that part of the second fish which is knocking on their door and they just need somebody to show them how to deal with it? And I don't think I can say it's always one or the other. It's a question of assessment.
But one of the things that you said is that when the God image is absent, the ego doesn't develop. And I'm wondering, because we're living in an age when the God image is collapsing, does that indicate that it's more difficult for children, for people, to develop the an ego? Because in other words, I would think that the your culture in which you live would be either a help or a hindrance in that psychological development.
Absolutely, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Can you give some examples of the God image and what literally that looks like?
Well, maybe we should do some dreams now. Well, here's a very simple one. To get us going. I was at the auditorium of the high school I attended. It looked the way it did when I attended school there, with big heavy pews that gave it the look of a chapel. So already we're in the religious area. It seemed perhaps I was a student in this dream. I was part of a large assembly. At each place there was a miniature book with a red cover, small enough to fit in the palm of your hand. Mine was the Ten Commandments. And I figured we were gathered for religious service. But then the assembly meeting was over, and I got up from my seat, and I noticed others had copies of a book entitled Myths to Live By. I wanted a copy of that book instead of the one I had, and began to go up and down the rows to see if any copies were still there. I wanted a copy of this book so much, I was prepared to steal it. It's not a good sign. I covertly exchanged my copy of the Ten Commandments for it. No such opportunity presented itself. Mm. See, that would be the old Ten Commandments, would be the vertical fish, and that's how this person was living. And the myth to live by would be finding the interior spirit. That's a very simple one.
So we're not literally talking about God image.
Oh yes, I'm just getting going.
I meant being just Christ or Buddha. It's something different. For
it me. Can, it could be, it could be specifically Christ or Buddha, or I didn't bring any of those along. Or now that you know this imagery, fish. But it could be. I probably see a Jesus dream a month.
People or their culture and their history and what they, you know, their orientations, what they've been tapped into.
It has nothing to do with that. It's really strange. No? You would think it would, but it doesn't.
It's deeper than that. Unconscious
stuff? That's Jung's view, certainly.
Okay.
Yeah, same.
Would you consider the feminine also with the God images, or do you consider that something different?
Same. Usually, the God image is dreamt of, maybe I shouldn't say that. I'd say it's often masculine, with the need to incorporate the feminine into it.
Are you seeing more nature?
Yeah.
Seeing more what?
Nature. And when Jesus appears, usually it's in a blasphemous way. You know, there'll be a mass and Jesus will come in and take a pee. Or he'll be making love on the altar with somebody. You heard the one about, I think I told you the one about the resurrection of Christ. Did I not?
What?
The priest dreamt that he was to witness the resurrection of Christ. And Christ was brought in the casket, and by pallbearers, and he was witnessing this. The casket cover arose, Christ arose, and she was a woman, and she wanted to make love, and he ran. There's a classic example. See that? You can see how in the unconscious, the way Christ is depicted is more along the lines of that second fish. And how the contemporary Christian attitude is incapable of dealing with it.
I have one little thing to sort of throw into the
on
that. I have a number of acquaintances or friends. They're not real close friends, but most of them, at least at this point. But the people that I know who are the most rabid atheists are all people, every single one of them, who had an absent alcoholic or abusive father. Is that in our culture, God is the Father.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea of God is formed on that, and people whose experience is destructive
negative,
and negative, they never develop that sense of their whole way of approaching the rest of their experience is really deeply wounded.
Mm-hmm.
I just thought I'd put that in.
Yeah. Well, it's the Father God that's the first fish.
And yet they can be wonderful people and contribute great things to society.
Do you agree with that?
Pardon? Oh, yeah, they often do. But their own interior experience is very distressed and unhappy and wrecked in a lot of ways.
Here's a fish. Classic fish dream. Mm-hmm. I'm in a large building like a museum or a hotel. There are lots of tanks of goldfish in different rooms. Some of the tanks get broken. There's a lot of water and glass and fish on the floor. I know I can't save all the fish, so I pick up one large one, about 14 inches long, gold like a perch, and carry it in my arms like a baby to try to find one of the other tanks to put it in. But I can't find any other tanks. I sense a communication with the fish. It's like I can understand what it's thinking. It communicates that it can live for a fairly long time out of water. I finally find a plastic bag and put some water in it, and the fish and I put the fish in it till I can find something better. That the aquarium would be the church. We'll get into this a little bit this afternoon. I just want to give you some taste of what this looks like. I see the church, the efficacy of the church in containing is not valid. And, you know, I really do think there are two kinds of people, those who are contained and those who are not contained. And it's sometimes, you know, if you ever heard me speaking and people sort of get irate at what you're saying about things like this, they're contained in the church and you just can't get it across. Well, you're contained, other people aren't. It means something to you, it means nothing to me. And that you see here in a dream like this. And if that's the boat you're in, then what you're faced with is not going to the church for containment, not swimming in the water, but taking a fish out of the water and beginning the dialogue with it. Beginning the dialogue with it would be the same as eating the second fish.
So you see that as the second half.
Right. This would be picking up in the third millennium. Our individual task, well, that's what we'll do this afternoon. our individual task is then, how do you come into relationship with the second fish? Jung had just been slowly building an argument. History, symbols, fish, integrate the second fish. Now we'll talk about, so how do you do that?
So you're talking about going into the Aquarius section.
So what's it, see what we're, if you can think with the symbolism, the age of Pisces, the fish swim in the water, and the age of Aquarius is the water carrier. And we're going to see pretty soon that Jung interprets water as doctrine. He doesn't interpret it, he takes it from the church.
See, somebody was just asking me about that Aquarius sign.
Yeah.
What I'm thinking of is in Pisces, you've got the two animals that you're working with, but in Aquarius, you've got a man.
Right.
Who is...
The only human of all the signs.
What? Say again?
It's the only human. All the other signs are animals.
Right.
The other thing about Aquarius is it's water. And if you look at it...
He carries the water.
But the actual glyph, of Aquarius is two wiggly lines.
Yeah.
So in other words, these two things that are moving together, and now they don't combine, they don't become one line, there's a distance between them, but their movement together is coordinated. And so it's like they're parallel. So that's an interesting thing of having these two things, that's another way to start looking at this. Do these things actually come together, or do they work together like a railroad track that supports? You know, you've got two lines in a railroad track, and it can carry something because there's equal support on both sides. So that glyph is a fascinating way to look at it.
He takes it from the point of view of the image of carrying the bucket of water.
Right.
Al says that glyph is not water. She says it's energy.
Energy. But it's a parallel thing working together. The other thing with the symbol of Aquarius is like he's pouring the water down onto the earth. So it's like this energy is flowing from the heavens down into the physical.
That's right.
I thought the figure was a woman, not a man. It's a man.
It's a man as far as I know. So you see, you've got
into a woman.
But we'll do this afternoon. But you've got a whole new set of images coming up now from the two fish to the water carrier, and we'll be talking about what that means, what that puts on us. I can read you one more dream. Well, let me see. Try and pick an easy one. It's one I want to look at, but it's a long one. It doesn't really answer the God image one, but this is one of my favorite dreams. Anyone remember that picture? It's again just to try to illustrate. Kind of backing off the question of the relationship to water. We'll get there this afternoon, but just concentrating on the second fish for a second. It's a dream that Jung cites in the dream analysis seminar. Here's the dream. It is as if I were seeing a sort of steamroller from a point above. The machine is going and is apparently making a road, forming a particular pattern like a labyrinth. Jung is reporting this guy's dream. And in the dream, he, that is the dreamer, thinks, that is my analysis. And then he is in the picture, which he has looked at from above. He is standing at the bifurcation of the road in a wood, and he does not know which way to go. At first, he did not pay much attention to the arabesque the machine was making. It's a guy who was married and was having a visit to brothels in Eastern Europe. And Jung took that steamroller and the fact that the guy's going all over the place as indicative of the guy's being driven by his own desire. And yet, what is so interesting is that when he drew it, it came out in the form of a mandala. Again, the same idea that through that second fish of desirousness, this guy was actually forming a new image of his identity. And that's what the work was about, was seeing how that, the business problem that he had, really was the portal into a new dimension of his identity, a new intensity in his marriage relationship, which was healed, and a new sense of self. And there you get this irony between the desire and the problem, the steamroller, what could be a cruder image of being, you know, tossed around by affect and desire, but yet what it produces is a image of organized identity. So the second fish becoming the portal to the spirit. Well, we'll pick up this afternoon. We'll talk about the water. And then how do you transform this second fish? We'll take a break. See you at 1:00.